Enquiry Concerning Human Understanding by David Hume, first published in 1748. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Sections 1 and 2. Section 1. The Different Kinds of Philosophy. Moral philosophy, or the science of human nature, can be treated in two different ways, each of which has its own special merit, and may contribute to the entertainment, instruction, and reformation of mankind. One of the two treatments considers man chiefly as born for action, and as guided in his conduct by taste and sentiment, i.e., feeling or opinion, pursuing one object and avoiding another, according to the value they seem to have, and according to the light in which they are presented. As virtue is agreed to be the most valuable thing one could pursue, philosophers of this kind paint virtue in the most charming colours, borrowing from poetry and eloquence, and treating their subject in an easy and obvious manner that is best fitted to please the reader's imagination and arouse his affections. They select the most striking observations and instances from common life. They set up proper contrasts between opposite characteristics, such as virtue and vice, generosity and meanness, and attracting us into the paths of virtue by visions of glory and happiness, they direct our steps in these paths by the soundest rules and the most vivid examples. They make us feel the difference between vice and virtue. They arouse and regulate our beliefs and feelings, and they think they have fully reached their goal if they manage to bend our hearts to the love of honesty and true honour. Philosophers of the other kind focus on man as a reasonable rather than as an active being, and try to shape his thinking more than to improve his behaviour. They regard human nature as a subject of theoretical inquiry, and they examine it intently, trying to find the principles that regulate our understanding, stir up our sentiments, and make us approve or blame this or that particular object, event, or action. They think it somewhat disgraceful that philosophy hasn't yet established an agreed account of the foundation of morals, reasoning, and artistic criticism, and that it goes on talking about truth and falsehood, vice and virtue, beauty and ugliness, without being able to fix the source of these distinctions. While they attempt this hard task, no difficulties deter them. Moving from particular instances to general principles, they then push their inquiries still further, to get to principles that are even more general. And they don't stop satisfied until they arrive at the basic principles that set the limits to human curiosity in every branch of knowledge. Though their theorizing seems abstract and even unintelligible to ordinary readers, they aim at getting the approval of the learned and the wise, and think themselves well enough compensated for their lifetime's work if they can bring out into the open some hidden truths that may contribute to the instruction of later generations. People in general will certainly always prefer the relaxed and obvious kind of philosophy to the carefully detailed and abstruse kind, and many will recommend the former as being not only more agreeable, but also more useful. It enters more into common life, moulds the heart and affections, and because it involves principles on which people act, it reforms their conduct and brings them nearer to the model of perfection that it describes. The abstruse philosophy, on the other hand, is based on a mental attitude that cannot enter into everyday business and action. So it vanishes when the philosopher comes out of the shadows into daylight, and its principles can't easily influence our behaviour. The feelings of our heart, the agitation of our passions, and the intensity of our affections dissipate all its conclusions and reduce the profound philosopher to a mere peasant. The easy philosophy, let us face the fact, has achieved more lasting fame than the other, and rightly so. Abstract reasoners have sometimes enjoyed a momentary reputation from the caprice or ignorance of their own age, but they haven't been able to maintain their high standing with later generations that weren't biased in their favour. It is easy for a profound abstract philosopher to make a mistake in his intricate reasonings, and one mistake is bound to lead to another, while the philosopher drives his argument forward and isn't deterred from accepting any conclusion by its unusual appearance or its contradiction to popular opinion. Not so with a philosopher who aims only to represent the common sense of mankind in more beautiful and more attractive colours. If by accident he falls into error, he goes no further. Rather than pushing on, he renews his appeal to common sense and to the natural sentiments of the mind, gets back onto the right path, and protects himself from any dangerous illusions. The fame of Cicero flourishes at present, but that of Aristotle is utterly decayed, and Addison may be read with pleasure when Locke has been entirely forgotten. To be a mere philosopher is usually not thought well of in the world, because such a person is supposed to contribute nothing to the advantage or pleasure of society, to live remote from communication with mankind, and to be wrapped up in principles and notions that they can't possibly understand. On the other hand, the mere ignoramus is still more despised, and at a time and place where learning flourishes, nothing is regarded as a surer sign of an ill-bred mind than having no taste at all for learning. The best kind of character is supposed to lie between those extremes, retaining an equal ability and taste for books, company, and business, preserving in conversation the discernment and delicacy that arise from literary pursuits, and in business the honesty and accuracy that are the natural result of a sound philosophy. In order to spread and develop such an accomplished kind of character, nothing can be more useful than writings in the easy style and manner which stay close to life, require no deep thought or solitary pondering to be understood, and send the reader back among mankind full of noble sentiments and wise precepts applicable to every demand of human life. By means of such writings, virtue becomes lovable, the pursuit of knowledge agreeable, the company of others instructive, and solitude entertaining. Man is a reasonable being, and as such he gets appropriate food and nourishment from the pursuit of knowledge. But the limits of human understanding are so narrow that we can't hope to know much or to know it securely. As well as being reasonable, man is a sociable being, but he can't always enjoy, indeed can't always want, agreeable and amusing company. Man is also an active being, and from that disposition of his, as well as from the various necessities of human life, he must put up with being busy at something. But the mind requires some relaxation, and can't always devote itself to careful work. It seems, then, that nature has pointed out a mixed kind of life as most suitable for the human race, and has secretly warned us not to tilt too far in any of these directions, and make ourselves incapable of other occupations and entertainments. "Indulge your passion for knowledge," says nature, "but seek knowledge of things that are human and directly relevant to action and society. As for abstruse thought and profound researches, I prohibit them, and if you engage in them, I will severely punish you by the brooding melancholy they bring, by the endless uncertainty in which they involve you, and by the cold reception your announced discoveries will meet with when you publish them. Be a philosopher, but amidst all your philosophy, be still a man." If people in general were contented to prefer the easy philosophy to the abstract and profound one, without throwing blame or contempt on the latter, it might be appropriate to go along with this general opinion, and to allow every man to enjoy, unopposed, his own taste and sentiment. But the friends of the easy philosophy often carry the matter further, even to the point of absolutely rejecting all profound reasonings, or what is commonly called metaphysics, and this rejection should not be allowed to pass unchallenged. So I shall now proceed to consider how the abstract kind of philosophy can be reasonably defended. Let us first observe that the carefully detailed and abstract kind of philosophy has one considerable advantage that comes from its being useful to the easy kind. Without help from abstract philosophy, the easy and human kind can never be exact enough in its sentiments, rules, or reasonings. All literature is nothing but pictures of human life in various attitudes and situations, and these inspire us with different sentiments of praise or blame, admiration or ridicule, according to the qualities of the object they set before us. An artist must be better qualified to succeed in presenting such pictures if, in addition to having delicate taste and being quick on the uptake, he has a detailed knowledge of the internal structure and operations of the understanding, the workings of the passions, and the various kinds of sentiment that discriminate vice and virtue. However difficult this search into men's interiors may appear to be, it is to some extent needed by anyone wanting to describe successfully the obvious and outward aspects of life and manners. The anatomist presents to the eye the most hideous and disagreeable objects, but his science is useful to the painter in presenting even a Venus or a Helen. While the painter employs all the richest colours of his art and gives his figures the most graceful and engaging airs, he still has to attend to the inward structure of the human body, the position of the muscles, the structure of the bones, and the function and shape of every bodily part or organ. Accuracy always helps beauty, and solid reasoning always helps delicate sentiment. It would be pointless to praise one by depreciating the other. Besides, it is notable that in every art or profession, even those of the most practical sort, a spirit of careful detail, however acquired, makes for greater perfection, and renders the activity more serviceable to the interests of society. And even if philosophers keep themselves far from the world of business and affairs, the spirit of philosophy, if carefully cultivated by a number of people, must gradually permeate the whole society, and bring philosophical standards of correctness to every art and calling. The politician will acquire greater foresight and subtlety in apportioning and balancing power, the lawyer more method and finer principles in his reasonings, and the army general more regularity in his discipline and more caution in his plans and operations. The growing stability of modern governments, compared with the ancient, has been accompanied by improvements in the precision of modern philosophy, and will probably continue to do so. Even if these studies brought no advantage beyond gratifying innocent curiosity, that curiosity ought not to be despised, for it's one route to safe and harmless pleasures, few of which have been bestowed on the human race. The sweetest and most inoffensive path of life leads through the avenues of knowledge and learning, and anyone who can either remove any obstacles along the path, or open up new views, ought to be regarded as, in that, a benefactor to mankind. And though these carefully detailed and abstract researches may appear difficult and fatiguing, some minds are like some bodies in this. Being endowed with vigorous and flourishing health, they need severe exercise, and get pleasure from activities that most people would find burdensome and laborious. Obscurity, indeed, is painful to the mind as well as to the eye, but to bring light from obscurity is bound to be delightful and rejoicing, whatever the labour. But this obscurity in the profound and abstract kind of philosophy is objected to, not only as painful and tiring, but also as the inevitable source of uncertainty and error. Here, indeed, lies the fairest and most plausible objection to a large part of metaphysics, that it isn't properly a science, i.e., isn't a disciplined pursuit of organized knowledge, but arises either from vain attempts to penetrate into subjects that are utterly inaccessible to the human understanding, or from the craft of popular superstitions which, being unable to defend themselves by fair arguments, raise these entangling metaphysical brambles to cover and protect their weakness. Chased from the open country, these robbers run into the forest and lie in wait to break in on every unguarded avenue of the mind, and overwhelm it with religious fears and prejudices. They can oppress the strongest and most determined antagonist if he lets up his guard for a moment, and many of their opponents, through cowardice and folly, open the gates to the enemies, the purveyors of superstition, and willingly and reverently submit to them as their legal sovereigns. But is this a good enough reason for philosophers to hold back from such researches, to retreat and leave superstition in possession of the battlefield? Isn't it proper to draw the opposite conclusion, and see the need to carry the war into the enemy's most secret recesses? It is no use hoping that frequent disappointment will eventually lead men to abandon such airy pursuits as the superstitious ones, and discover the proper province of human reason. For one thing, many people get too much advantage from perpetually recalling such topics. Also, there is no place for blind despair in the pursuit of knowledge, for however unsuccessful former attempts may have proved, there is always room to hope that the hard work, good luck, or improved intelligence of succeeding generations will reach discoveries that were unknown in former ages. Each adventurous thinker will still leap at the elusive prize, and find himself stimulated rather than discouraged by the failures of his predecessors, while he hopes that the glory of succeeding in such a hard adventure is reserved for him alone. So those friends who like superstition and bad philosophy will never just give up. The only way to free learning from entanglement in these abstruse questions is to inquire seriously into the nature of human understanding, and through an exact analysis of its powers, show that it is not at all fitted for such remote and abstruse subjects. We must submit to this fatigue in order to live at ease ever after, and we must cultivate true metaphysics carefully, in order to destroy metaphysics of the false and adulterated kind. Laziness protects some people from this deceitful philosophy, but others are carried into it by curiosity, and despair, which at some moments prevails, may later be replaced by optimistic hopes and expectations. Accurate and valid reasoning is the only universal remedy fitted for all people of all kinds, lazy and curious, despairing and hopeful, and it alone can undercut that abstruse philosophy and metaphysical jargon that get mixed up with popular superstition, presenting the latter in a manner that casual reasoners can't understand, and giving it the air of real knowledge and wisdom. So a carefully detailed scrutiny of the powers and faculties of human nature helps us to reject, after careful inquiry, the most uncertain and disagreeable part of learning. And it also brings many positive advantages. It is a remarkable fact about the operations of the mind that, although they are most intimately present to us, whenever we try to reflect on them, they seem to be wrapped in darkness, and the eye of the mind can't easily detect the lines and boundaries that distinguish them from one another. The objects of this scrutiny, i.e. the operations of the mind, are so rarefied that they keep changing, so they have to be grasped in an instant, which requires great sharpness of mind, derived from nature and improved by habitual use. So it comes about that in the pursuit of knowledge, a considerable part of the task is simply to know the different operations of the mind, to separate them from each other, to classify them properly, and to correct all the seeming disorder in which they lie when we reflect on them. This task of ordering and distinguishing has no merit when it's performed on external bodies, the objects of our senses. But when it's directed towards the operations of the mind, it is valuable in proportion to how hard it is to do. Even if we get no further than this mental geography, this marking out of the distinct parts and powers of the mind, it's at least a satisfaction to go that far. And the more obvious this study is, and it isn't at all obvious, the more contemptible it must be for those who claim to be learned and philosophical, to be ignorant of it. Nor can there remain any suspicion that this branch of knowledge, the pursuit of carefully detailed and abstract philosophy, is uncertain and illusory, unless we adopt a scepticism that is entirely subversive of all theoretical inquiry, and even of all action. It can't be doubted that the mind is endowed with various powers and faculties, that these are distinct from each other, that what is really distinct to the immediate perception may be distinguished by reflection, and consequently that in all propositions on this subject, there are true ones and false ones, and sorting them out lies within the reach of human understanding. There are many obvious distinctions of this kind, such as those between the will and the understanding, the imagination and the passions, which every human creature can grasp, and the finer and more philosophical distinctions are no less real and certain, though they are harder to grasp. Some successes in these inquiries, especially some recent ones, can give us a better idea of the certainty and solidity of this branch of learning. Will we think it worth the effort of an astronomer to give us a true system of the planets, and to determine the position and order of those remote bodies, while we turn our noses up at those who so successfully determine the parts of the mind, a topic which for us comes very close to home? But may we not hope that philosophy, if carried out with care and encouraged by the attention of the public, will carry its researches still further? Might it not get beyond the task of distinguishing and sorting out the operations of the mind, and discover, at least in some degree, the secret springs and drivers by which the human mind is actuated in its operations? Astronomers were for a long time contented with proving from the phenomena the true motions, order, and size of the heavenly bodies, until at last a scientist, Isaac Newton, came along and also determined the laws and forces by which the revolutions of the planets are governed and directed. Similar things have been done with regard to other parts of nature, and we can reasonably hope that our inquiries into the powers and organization of the mind will be equally successful if we carry them out as ably and alertly as those other scientists did their work. It is probable that one operation of the mind depends on another, which may in turn be brought under a still more general and universal one. And it will be difficult for us to determine exactly how far these researches can be carried, difficult before we have carefully tried, and difficult even after. This much is certain. Attempts of this kind are made every day even by those who philosophize the most carelessly, and the greatest need is to embark on the project with thorough care and attention, so that if the task does lie within reach of human understanding, it can eventually end in success, and if it doesn't, it can be rejected with some confidence and security. But this last conclusion is not desirable, and shouldn't be arrived at rashly, for it detracts from the beauty and value of this sort of philosophy. Moralists, considering the vast number and variety of actions that arouse our approval or dislike, have always been accustomed to search for some common principle, some common cause or source, on which this variety of sentiments might depend. And though their passion for a single general principle has sometimes carried them too far, they are excusable in expecting to find some general principles under which all the vices and virtues can rightly be brought. Similar attempts have been made by literary critics, logicians, and even students of politics, and their attempts have met with some success, though these studies may come even nearer to completion when they have been given more time, greater accuracy, and more intensive study. To throw up at once all claims to this kind of knowledge seems to be more rash, precipitate, and dogmatic than even the boldest and most affirmative philosophy that has ever attempted to impose its crude dictates and principles on mankind. If these reasonings concerning human nature seem abstract and hard to understand, what of it? This isn't evidence of their falsehood. On the contrary, it seems impossible that what has until now escaped so many wise and profound philosophers can be very obvious and easy to discover. And whatever efforts these researches may cost us, we can think ourselves sufficiently rewarded, not only in profit but also in pleasure, if by that means we can come to know anything more on topics of such enormous importance. Still, the abstract nature of these speculations is a drawback, rather than an advantage, but perhaps this difficulty can be overcome by care and skill, and the avoidance of all unnecessary detail. So in the following inquiry, I shall try to throw some light on subjects from which wise people have been deterred by uncertainty, and ignorant people have been deterred by obscurity. how good it would be to be able to unite the boundaries of the different kinds of philosophy by reconciling profound inquiry with clearness and truth with novelty. And still better, if by reasoning in this easy manner I can undermine the foundations of an abstruse philosophy that seems always to have served only as a shelter to superstition and a cover to absurdity and error. Section 2. The Origin of Ideas. Everyone will freely admit that the perceptions of the mind, when a man feels the pain of excessive heat or the pleasure of moderate warmth, are considerably unlike what he feels when he later remembers this sensation or earlier looks forward to it in his imagination. Memory and imagination may mimic or copy the perceptions of the senses, but they can't create a perception that equals the force and liveliness of the one they are copying. Even when they operate with greatest vigour, the most we will say is that they represent their object so vividly that we could almost say we feel or see it. Except when the mind is disordered by disease or madness, memory and imagination can never be lively enough to create perceptions that are indistinguishable from the ones we have in seeing or feeling. The most lively thought is still dimmer than the dullest sensation. A similar distinction runs through all the other perceptions of the mind. A real fit of anger is very different from merely thinking of that emotion. If you tell me that someone is in love, I understand your meaning, and form a correct conception of the state he is in. But I would never mistake that conception for the turmoil of actually being in love. When we think back on our past sensations and feelings, our thought is a faithful mirror that copies its objects truly, but it does so in colours that are fainter and more washed out than those in which our original perceptions were clothed. To tell one from the other, you don't need careful thought or philosophical ability. So we can divide the mind's perceptions into two classes, on the basis of their different degrees of force and liveliness. The less forcible and lively are commonly called thoughts or ideas. The others have no name in our language, or in most others, presumably because we don't need a general label for them, except for philosophical purposes. Let us, then, take the liberty of calling them impressions, using that word in a slightly unusual sense. By the term impression, then, I mean all our more lively perceptions when we hear or see or feel or love or hate or desire or will. These are to be distinguished from ideas, which are the fainter perceptions of which we are conscious when we reflect on, look inwards at, our impressions. It may seem at first sight that human thought is utterly unbounded. It not only escapes all human power and authority, as when a poor man thinks of becoming wealthy overnight, or an ordinary citizen thinks of being a king, but isn't even confined within the limits of nature and reality. It is as easy for the imagination to form monsters, and to join incongruous shapes and appearances, as it is to conceive the most natural and familiar objects. And while the body must creep laboriously over the surface of one planet, thought can instantly transport us to the most distant regions of the universe, and even further. What never was seen or heard of may still be conceived. Nothing is beyond the power of thought, except what implies an absolute contradiction. But although our thought seems to be so free, when we look more carefully, we'll find that it is really confined within very narrow limits, and that all this creative power of the mind amounts merely to the ability to combine, transpose, enlarge, or shrink the materials that the senses and experience provide us with. When we think of a golden mountain, we only join two consistent ideas, gold and mountain, with which we were already familiar. We can conceive a virtuous horse, because our own feelings enable us to conceive virtue, and we can join this with the shape of a horse, which is an animal we know. In short, all the materials of thinking are derived either from our outward senses or from our inward feelings. The mind and the will merely mix and combine these materials. Put in philosophical terminology, all our ideas or more feeble perceptions are copies of our impressions or more lively ones. Here are two arguments that I hope will suffice to prove this. First, when we analyze our thoughts or ideas, however complex or elevated they are, we always find them to be made up of simple ideas that were copied from earlier feelings or sensations. Even ideas that at first glance seem to be the furthest removed from that origin are found on closer examination to be derived from it. The idea of God, meaning an infinitely intelligent, wise, and good being, comes from extending beyond all limits the qualities of goodness and wisdom that we find in our own minds. However far we push this inquiry, we shall find that every idea that we examine is copied from a similar impression. Those who maintain that this isn't universally true, and that there are exceptions, have only one way of refuting it, but it should be easy for them, if they are right. They need merely to produce an idea that they think isn't derived from this source. It will then be up to me, if I am to maintain my doctrine, to point to the impression or lively perception that corresponds to the idea they have produced. Second, if a man can't have some kind of sensation because there is something wrong with his eyes, ears, etc., he will never be found to have corresponding ideas. A blind man can't form a notion of colours, or a deaf man a notion of sounds. If either is cured of his deafness or blindness, so that the sensations can get through to him, the ideas can then get through as well. And then he will find it easy to conceive these objects. The same is true for someone who has never experienced an object that will give a certain kind of sensation. A Laplander or Negro has no notion of the taste of wine, because he has never had the sensation of tasting wine. Similarly, with inward feelings, it seldom, if ever, happens that a person has never felt or is wholly incapable of some human feeling or emotion. But the phenomenon I am describing does occur with feelings as well, though in lesser degree. A gentle person can't form any idea of determined revenge or cruelty, nor can a selfish one easily conceive the heights of friendship and generosity. Everyone agrees that non-human beings may have many senses of which we could have no conception, because the ideas of them have never been introduced to us in the only way in which an idea can get into the mind, namely, through actual feeling and sensation. So here is a proposition that not only seems to be simple and intelligible in itself, but could, if properly used, make every dispute equally intelligible by banishing all that nonsensical jargon that has so long dominated metaphysical reasonings. All ideas, especially abstract ones, are naturally faint and obscure, so that the mind has only a weak hold on them. Ideas are apt to be mixed up with other ideas that resemble them. We tend to assume that a given word is associated with a determinate idea, just because we have used it so often, even if in using it we haven't had any distinct meaning for it, i.e. haven't associated it with any definite idea. In contrast with this, all our impressions, i.e. all our outward or inward sensations, are strong and vivid. The boundaries between them are more exactly placed, and it is harder to make mistakes about them. So when we come to suspect that a philosophical term is being used without any meaning or idea, as happens all too often, we need only to ask, from what impression is that supposed idea derived? If none can be pointed out, that will confirm our suspicion that the term is meaningless, i.e., has no associated idea. By bringing ideas into this clear light, we may reasonably hope to settle any disputes that arise about whether they exist and what they are like. A final note on this topic. Philosophers who have denied that there are any innate ideas probably meant only that all ideas were copies of our impressions, though I have to admit that the terms in which they expressed this were not chosen with enough care or defined with enough precision to make clear exactly what their doctrine was. For what is meant by innate? If innate is equivalent to natural, then all the perceptions and ideas of the mind must be granted to be innate or natural, in whatever sense we take the latter word, whether in opposition to what is uncommon, to what is artificial, or to what is miraculous. If innate means contemporary with our birth, the dispute seems to be frivolous. There's no point in inquiring when thinking begins, whether before, at, or after our birth. Again, the word idea seems commonly to be taken in a very loose sense by Locke and others, who use it to stand for any of our perceptions, sensations, and passions, as well as thoughts. I would like to know what it can mean to assert that self-love, or resentment of injuries, or the passion between the sexes is not innate. End of section 2.